Hello and welcome to Monday. This is Banfield. When the bombs fall down, gas prices go up. It is just the way of war. And there may have been no better example than today. The worst day of air attacks in Ukraine since the war began. And brace yourself. Russia says it's only the beginning, and that's going to affect you. 80-plus missiles fired from land, sea, and air took aim squarely at pretty much all of Ukraine, terrorizing millions who were on their way to work and, get this, on their way to school. And it literally devastated that country's power grid. Ukraine says it shot down roughly half of the missiles and more than a dozen Iranian-built drones, but it couldn't prevent an onslaught that the Biden administration calls horrific and utter brutality. It was also, in a sense, predictable after this stunning attack by Ukraine over the weekend on a key bridge that links Russia with its prized possession, Crimea. For Vladimir Putin, humiliated time and again in all these regions that he says he owns and doesn't, that literally was a bridge too far. Here is what his revenge looked like. Seeing those images is hard. Harder still is figuring out how all that carnage over there affects you over here. When it comes to rising gas prices, some politicians scream that it's all Putin's fault. Others say, not so fast. And it may affect how you vote in just 4 weeks' time. Here's the breakdown of how it really works without the politics. Oil prices all around the world spiked when Russia attacked, and Republicans were all too happy to blame the Biden administration. Biden's team managed to bring some of the prices down by tapping into our rainy day reserves, even though not everybody agreed this is a rainy day. But last week, another monkey wrench hit us. OPEC, the organization of oil-producing countries that always get together to decide the price of a barrel of oil for the rest of us. And they did something drastic. They cut their production by 2 million barrels a day. Oh, just ahead of midterms. You know, less oil on the market means we have higher prices at the gas pump, right? And conventional wisdom says that that cartel who's pretty friendly with Russia is meddling in the U.S. elections by driving up the gas prices and making American drivers mad at the government. The added benefit? Mr. Putin makes a whole lot more money when his oil sells high. Some Democrats are so convinced of that that they are threatening to cut off U.S. weapons supplies to Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia is a big driver of OPEC's decision to pull back on the supply and kind of screw us. But there is a less devious explanation for what OPEC did. It's possible that all those countries who belong to OPEC are simply bracing themselves for a recession and that they are worried that prices are going to plummet in a few months and they're going to be left with a massive stock of oil that they can't sell at the price they should want to sell. But no matter why they did it, gas is still gonna go up. So what do we do about it here? Is it time for the U.S. to shop around for other suppliers? Because Iran and Venezuela are sure willing to sell. Both of them have long been sidelined in that global market for obvious reasons. But why is this even a problem for us? The United States of America, surprisingly, is still the largest supplier of crude oil in the world. Bigger than Saudi Arabia. Bigger than Russia. Why do we even need foreign oil? My next guests have some answers to all those questions. Jonathan Sanders is a former Moscow correspondent for CBS News. He is currently a professor of journalism at Stony Brook University. He's also the author of The Russians Emerge. Laura Ballman is an international business consultant and former CIA operations officer who ran a counterintelligence division for the United States Department of Energy and the National Laboratory Complex. And Hossein Askari is professor emeritus at George Washington University. He served on the executive board of the International Monetary Fund, representing Saudi Arabia. He's mediated between Mideast countries and advises United States companies, as well as U.S. CENTCOM and the United States Treasury on these issues. Welcome, one and all. Laura, I want to begin with you. Should we really be rethinking our alliances at this point? And while you answer that, I just want to treat our viewers to the latest video out of Iran, one of those possible realliances. It's basically what's happening that's new with all those protesters in Iran who are sick and tired of the religious rule. They're now firing up roadblocks and blockades, and they are, you know, setting them ablaze and making things look pretty damn like a war zone in there. So while you answer that, I want people to realize who it would be that we'd be aligned with.
We should keep our alliances with NATO and our traditional alliances. We should not rethink our alliances with dictators, with Venezuela, Iran, Russia. We have a choice. Energy is strength, and we can either do business with some pretty dirty folks, or we can produce oil ourselves.
Oil. So it's kind of a deal with the devil, though, isn't it?
Which? Producing it ourselves?
I'm going to get you. No, I'm talking about rethinking our alliance with Iran. I'll get to Venezuela in a moment, but these are pictures of Iran. Obviously, we're seeing, you know, kids getting killed in the street, and it's still the Ayatollah's regime there. Would we want to get into bed with a country like this again, given, you know, that they're mortal enemies at this point?
No, absolutely not. As long as the mullahs are in charge in Iran, we do not want to buy oil from them.
That's what I thought you'd say. So, Hossein, jump in on Venezuela. You know, I have a lot of questions about Venezuela. Venezuela is not the friendliest nation. It's clearly a troublemaker for the United States. And it is a, I don't know, hot mess, maybe the right word for it. They've been out of the game so long, I don't even know if their, you know, machines work anymore.
Well, I think when you take Venezuela today, their oil fields are, you know, have not been invested in. Their oil industry is a mess. Maduro is definitely a dictator. But I think we do have a habit as a country of putting people into corners, branding them, and then demonizing them. I listened to what was just said, but I find it very, very interesting that we say these words about the mullahs, and they're absolutely correct. They have done a horrible job. The Iranian people are not free. But I think then to say we jump into bed with the likes of MBS and the Al Sauds, I'm so sorry. That is a little bridge too far for me to say that the Al Sauds are okay and they have committed.
No, I don't think that's what I said.
Please let me finish. Please let me finish.
Sure.
Please let me finish. That they have committed what many people say is the most horrific act of this century, what they've done in Yemen. We give them the bombs, we supply them with all the intelligence, we refuel them with airplanes, we do all of that, and we look the other way when they do their things. I'm not defending Iran, I'm not defending Venezuela, but I think we have to be honest with ourselves.
Certainly,
so
I
go ahead and respond.
Well, certainly I agree with you that there are some serious problems with the Saudi regime. And my comments about Iran, and I would extend those to Venezuela, is not in any way condoning MBS or some of the others who have committed horrible human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia. So I think we can agree on that.
Yeah, so Jonathan, jump in here with the geopolitical shifts here, because it sure looks like a shift between, or an alliance between these two, MBS and Putin. It sure looks to Americans like this is a thumb in the eye to Biden.
Ashley, you and I are journalists. MBS signed off on the murder of a Washington Post journalist. We've got a lot of weapons in there that protect Riyadh and other places from attacks. Those weapons, Patriot missiles, ought to be moved to Kiev. Venezuela is a very different story from Iran. I don't think we should be doing anything to throw a lifeline to Iran right now. It looks like there is a chance that a woman-led protest movement is significantly destabilizing, getting the regime to rethink. But what we're seeing in what's going on with oil prices, blaming Putin is fine. And it might even have some points of justice. But there are things that we can do. But what are the Russians busy doing? They've got two kinds of agendas going on now. The first one is, I just saw the points of propaganda for discussing the bombing of the Kerch Bridge. And they're telling people to say that America is divided, not that many people want to support us. NATO is on its last legs with being able to run weapons into us. But the other thing they're doing is they're trying to get Americans through their mass media and through their social media campaigns to be talking particularly about who is to blame for rising gasoline prices. So the more we talk about that, the happier we're making the little propagandists who look for the wedges in our system. But I think, Ashley, there's something more significant that we missed today. Yes, there's cruelty. Yes, Putin is a hard man bent on revenge. But there are, he had some of his Navy ships overshoot the airspace of the little country of Moldova. Moldova has complained. Belarus, his neighbor, is saying that the Americans are destabilizing and training in Poland, Lithuania, and Ukraine Belarusian radical militants to come home to our country and attack. So we're going to put our forces on our western borders. And by the way, we're having more Russians coming in. So the war is getting spread out.
It is. And here's something that I think a lot of Americans looking at this, it gets to be a lot to take in. We all have our issues at home, especially in our own homes. We're busy people. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot to juggle. And the last thing we can do is, you know, sort of figure out the arcane aspect of what's going on, you know, in Russia's strategy against Ukraine and vice versa. But Laura, I think the question that a lot of Americans ask is, why are we in this boat? Damn it. Anyway, we're the largest oil producer in the world. Can't we pump more domestic oil? What's going on with our, you know, our prized reserves?
Well, it's politics. I mean, look, we are the world's leading producer of oil and natural gas, and our emissions have been declining faster than any other industrialized nation. We've reduced them by 14% in just 15 years. So it's unfortunately, like many issues in our public discourse today, energy and environmentalism is sort of has taken diametrically opposed corners of the same room, unfortunately, because we can produce oil in an environmentally responsible way. And right now in the White House, there's a conflict between the national security team and the domestic policy on this issue. Energy is a national security issue. We can fund Putin's war and dictators by buying their oil. We can push Russia to sell it to China, all these adversaries, or we can look for ways to produce it in an environmentally sound way ourselves.
So there was another real political move, and it happened before, you know, Putin decided to attack Ukraine, and that was scrapping the Keystone XL pipeline. Mm-hmm. And Hussein, I'd love to get your thoughts on whether there's a time and a place to revisit what people may have thought was a bad idea at that, or some people may have thought was a bad idea, and some people may no longer think that's a bad idea. You know, Alaska still is a rich reserve, pristine as it maybe. But what are your thoughts about the fact that America may rejig how it thinks? Democrats, particularly, you know, far left liberals, possibly, because we're in this boat.
Well, I think that you have to understand that really to produce more oil, the United States cannot really easily just turn on a key and you have more oil. When you want to produce more oil, you have to look at the actual technology of producing it. You have an oil field, and to produce more, it has a certain capacity And if you want to go beyond that, you, in fact, ruin the field. And America really cannot produce that much more oil. When you take a place like the Persian Gulf in Saudi Arabia or in Kuwait or anywhere else there, you get a barrel of oil much, much cheaper than you can get it in Alaska or in the United States. The United States is basically producing almost at its maximum. We can produce more oil by doing more fracking, which a lot of people don't want to do. We can give more incentives, but those are marginal, marginal changes. We need oil from other places in this world. And we have to realize that when you look at the oil reserves, the largest oil reserves in the world are actually in Venezuela. Venezuela has by far the largest oil reserve, more than Saudi Arabia. But again, it has a problem. The kind of oil that comes from Venezuela is a heavier oil from Lake Maracaibo. And so it doesn't give you
It's not exactly the right solution. I get it. It gets some oils very, very expensive to pull out of the ground and put in your tank, like the oil sands, very expensive, and sometimes you can't recoup the cost because of the production. I have to leave it there. But thank you, to all three of you, Hussein Askari, Laura Baumann, and Jonathan Sanders. Appreciate this really wise discussion.
Thank you.
Still to come, the experts say if you want to catch a killer, you have to think like a killer. And tonight, a killer is on the loose in Stockton, California. But how do you get inside the mind of a murderer to get ahead of his next move? Jeffrey Dahmer's lawyer may know that answer best. And we have the exclusive interview with him next. Plus, the journalist who interviewed Dahmer with her thoughts on how to stay one step ahead of a serial killer. Straight ahead. Welcome back. A community holds its collective breath, waiting and watching to see if a serial killer in Stockton, California takes another victim, or if the monster is finally caught. The Stockton killer is now tied to at least 7 shootings and 6 deaths over the past 17 months. And if you're like me, the minute you hear a serial killer's on the loose, your mind goes directly to that guy, Jeffrey Dahmer, the worst of the worst. There is a reason that Netflix is clocking its highest numbers in history right now with its Jeffrey Dahmer series. People are simply fascinated with who Dahmer was and why he did what he did. His attorney, Jerry Boyle, may know Dahmer best, right there on the left. He spent years with that madman, crafting a defense, sitting side by side in court, day after day, trying to prove to the jury that Dahmer was insane. Jerry Boyle knows a thing or two about the way a serial killer thinks and the way they plan. And he just may have insight on the Stockton killer's next move, too. In a moment, he's going to share all of that with you in our exclusive interview. Will it help track the Stockton killer? Because in addition to the 5 killings between July and September of this year in Stockton, police say the same gun was used in 2 other shootings more than an hour away in Oakland. Those 2 shootings happened more than a year ago, and while the first victim died, the second victim, she lived, and she told her story to the police.
The train started to come towards me. I mean, I was on the side, and then a man came around the corner, or whoever came around the corner, and they already had the gun out, and they just started shooting. So I ran towards them knowing that I'd have to get closer to the street if I wanted to survive. Because I wanted to lay down. I just wanted to go to sleep. I mean, there's a burning that's incredible. You're wet all over. You don't know why you're wet.
Here is the rub. That's Natasha Latour. And she says police wrote her off because she was homeless at the time. She says she only learned about the new killings by watching the news. Natasha says that the man who tried to kill her was between 5'10 and 6 feet. He was dressed in dark pants, a dark hooded sweater, and a black mask, which, by the way, take a look, it squares almost exactly with the only images we may have so far of the Stockton killer. This guy, this person of interest right here, caught on surveillance camera near one of the killings. And you can see something unique here. He's got a distinctive posture and a very interesting gait. The way he walks kind of leans to the left. And authorities are hoping that that may help identify him. They're also trying to profile him. The police chief says the suspect does not rob his victims, so it appears he's just kind of on a mission to kill. A theory echoed by criminologist Dr. Scott Bond. Here's what he said during an interview with News Nation.
I think is a better than 50-50 likelihood is that this individual has given himself a mission to rid the Stockton area of homeless people. For whatever reason, he has given himself this mission.
But despite all of this, it is still really, really tough to get inside the mind of a murderer. But Jeffrey Dahmer's lawyer has been there, inside that dark and evil place where Dahmer hatched his sick and murderous plans. And he's here to tell us all about it after the break. Plus, the reporter who sat face to face with Dahmer for the interview of her life. That's all next. Welcome back. When will the next body be found? That is keeping police and residents up at night in Stockton, California, because a serial killer is operating under the cover of night and is already tied to six murders, with a seventh victim who survived. The so-called Stockton killer wears dark clothing and a black COVID-style mask. He takes aim and shoots to kill quickly and quietly before disappearing back into the night. Five of the victims died between July and September of this year. But now police believe he's also killed at least one man back in April of 2021, about an hour away in Oakland. And then that woman who survived. So they're hauling out the case files now, left and right, to see if the unsolved murders may have been the handiwork of the Stockton killer. And they're drawing up a profile, too, for this killer to get inside his head before he strikes again. It is something that the police did back in the 80s, when victims began to fall one by one in Wisconsin. They died at the hands of one of America's most notorious serial killers, Jeffrey Dahmer. He killed, dismembered, and even ate parts of his 17 victims before police took him down. That's when the interviews began, and his lawyer learned everything there was to know about how and why Dahmer became a serial killer. It is extraordinary information for detectives who track killers these days. Jerry Boyle was Dahmer's lead attorney, and he joins me live tonight in this News Nation exclusive. Jerry, it's good to see you again after so many years. Thank you so much for being here with me. I'll start with a fairly broad question, and that is this. What is the most important thing you learned from all of your time with Jeffrey Dahmer that could help others try to track and profile killers like him?
Ashley, a couple of things. First of all, it's nice to see you again. You're as lovely as ever. I am very hard of hearing. Nothing from here on down is working like it used to. I had too many artillery shells that I've had blasted, and my ears are, I'm virtually deaf now. So if I can't hear you, I have my wife sitting behind me, and she'll whisper to me as if she's like an interpreter. So having said that, I have to ask you to repeat your question.
You bet. Not a problem at all. What's the most important thing you learned from Jeffrey Dahmer in all your time with him that can help us understand serial killers?
See, what learning?
How you understand serial killers.
Oh, I think I do. I was a prosecutor many years ago, and I tried the very first serial killer in Milwaukee County's history. He was a very, very evil man. He killed two girls and tried to kill a third. So I had some experience with serial killers. Then I end up representing the last one in Milwaukee County's history. So I have an idea of what they're all about. I also had the advantage of talking to the FBI agent who conceived the word serial killer. And I got his explanation about what serial killers are all about. So I was pretty well versed on Dahmer's situation when we went to trial.
So, and I'll get your wife to repeat this for you. It might be even more helpful. What did you learn from all the time with Dahmer? What did you learn about him and how his mind worked?
Well, first of all, he was the loneliest man I've ever known in my life. Absolutely without friendship, absolutely without any goals in life other than to work out this fantasy of having sex with a dead or unconscious person. That was the only thing he was living for. That's how sad it is. And when you engaged him in conversation, it isn't like you and I are having the conversation. It was, he waited for me to ask him something, he answered it, then he'd wait for me to ask him something else, then he'd answer it. So having a conversation with this man was virtually impossible because, as I think, he just wasn't like the rest of us. So I learned that, as I said, his loneliness, I think, drove him to this reckless conduct. I think that's the only thing I can add.
So your second chair who worked beside you, the other defense attorney in this case, Wendy Patrickus, she said that her impression was he was so lonely, like you said, he didn't want these people to leave. And so he'd kill them in a way to keep them with him. Do you think that's an accurate portrayal?
Accurate portrayal that Wendy said about keeping the bodies.
Well, Wendy Patrickus, who did a very good job on the Netflix show, her assignment was to talk to Dahmer. We had a 157-page confession. So we had to go through that. She went through it, and then we'd have him comment, and she taped it. So be it. But the long and the short of it is Dahmer told us nothing more or nothing less than what he wrote in that confession. So it was pretty easy getting down to the nitty gritty of this thing. And if you read the confession or listened carefully to the projection that was made on the Netflix show, what you see is a very strange young man who had very strange ideas to the point where, in my opinion, after having consulted with doctors and they came up with the idea that, in fact, he was mentally ill, that Dahmer just got sicker and sicker, crazier and crazier, which each day after he committed the first murder many years ago and then started up about 8 years later. So it was pretty simple, Ashley, to see what this was all about and defending him. When I say defending him, it was our obligation to get to the bottom of everything we could. And therefore, I had to go forward once I had good psychiatrists who said he was legally insane to explain it to the world at large. So hopefully somebody would see things in this man that would be able to use and try to determine whether or not there's any other serial killers manifesting conduct that would lead someone to believe that they must be watched or, in fact, put under some control.
You know, it's the system that we have, and it's a good one. Everyone deserves a defense, no matter how awful they are. And it's hard to do the job. So, Jerry, I'm going to be one to say thank you for doing the work that you've done, your entire body of work. That was a hell of a case, and I think you navigated it really well. I'm so glad to see you again. Thank you for being on tonight. This has been a real privilege.
God bless you, Ashley. God bless you.
And right back at you. Jerry Boyle joining us exclusively tonight, the attorney who represented Jeffrey Dahmer. I want to bring in someone else who had the very rare opportunity to get to know Dahmer and his family. Nancy Glass is an Emmy Award-winning producer and the CEO of Glass Entertainment Group. She interviewed Dahmer behind bars back in 93 for Inside Edition. He was killed less than a year later, by the way, by his fellow inmates. Great to see you, Nancy. You know, I'm a huge fan. I watched you on Inside Edition forever. And so I feel like I'm seeing an old friend right now. We could go on and on about that.
I feel the same way about you. I'm honored to be on your show, frankly.
I'm so pleased. And we love your daughter, Sloane Glass, by the way, on News Nation. I'll just add that, too. So let's get to Dahmer for a second here.
Yeah.
You know, that is a really rare and remarkable opportunity for a journalist to get with a member of our flock who has gone so far out of our confines to figure out how they get out there, what takes them out there, and then what brings them back to get another one of us. So tell me your thoughts about the man you went face to face with.
Well, you know, Gerald Boyle brought up some very true things about his loneliness. But here was the thing. He said the only happiness and satisfaction he had was from killing people. This was a man who, when he was born, his mother never let anybody touch him except to change his diaper or to hold him for a photograph. So he never had any attachment. And yes, he was lonely, but really, he really wanted to kill. And it's interesting because, you know, listening to you talk about what's going on in California, it's very interesting because like with Jeffrey Dahmer and other serial killers I've talked with, you know, lack of detection leads to escalation. So what happens with these serial killers is they try it once and they don't get detected. They wait a little longer. They don't get detected. And then they say to themselves, wow, I can do this. And the other thing I want to say about the Stockton killer, because I know you're interested in similarities or differences, is you also said something that was very interesting. You were talking about his gait. You were talking about what he was wearing. Well, think about how forensics and investigations have changed over the last few years. When were there ever surveillance cameras that could help people before? And when were there ever, I mean, now there's cell phones, surveillance cameras, and now also law enforcement is connected all across the nation. So that should help people. But this idea of escalation, just like with Jeffrey Dahmer, I believe that's what's going on in this serial killer's mind as well.
And we also have, you know, genetic family tree, you know, database as well, which has been remarkably helpful. Let me do this. I want to show our audience some of your amazing work on this story from Inside Edition back in the 90s. This is a clip about the remorse, the whole question of remorse that his, you know, victims and their families, you know, wanted to know about. Take a look.
Do you ever think about your victims?
I've often wondered why I haven't had more dreams or nightmares about what I've done. For some reason, it's like it's blocked off from part of my mind. If I dwelled on the subject all the time, I wouldn't be able to function.
What do you want to say to the families of the victims?
I had no intention of hurting them. I was extremely selfish. I was only thinking of myself, my own pleasure, my own perverted desires.
You know, the families of the victims don't believe in your conversion or your sorrow.
Oh, right. And if I was on their end of the table, I wouldn't either. Ultimately, I'm accountable to the Lord Jesus Christ. He'll be my final judge.
Can your sins be forgiven?
The Lord Jesus Christ shed blood is powerful enough to wipe out even my sins.
It's just astounding to see him so measured, seemingly normal, and then realize what he was capable of and what he'd done. Do you think he'd ever have stopped killing had he not been caught?
He said he would have never stopped. And by the way, although he expressed extreme remorse to me, he was a psychopath. You have to remember that. He was a skilled liar. So who knows what he really felt in the end.
Did we ever get much information about that jailhouse killing where he was murdered by fellow inmates?
Yes. Well, Jeffrey Dahmer stayed up all night and slept all day because he couldn't face the daylight. He said to me he wished he had the death penalty. He didn't want to live anymore because he didn't like his existence in prison. So he regularly taunted his fellow prisoners, and he regularly, you know, he wanted to die. And I believe that he you know, sought out somebody who would kill him. The irony is he was killed with a barbell, which was the first weapon he used when he killed his first victim.
That is something else. Oh, Nancy Glass, it's just been a pleasure to have you. It's great to see you again. Thanks so much. I want to have you back on any topic, you name it.
Thank you.
So coming up, investigators in Georgia scrambling to find a toddler who disappeared almost a week ago. But they now fear that he didn't disappear on his own. Our Brian Enten joins me live when we come back. Today marks 5 days since anyone laid eyes on 20-month-old Quentin Simon. Quentin disappeared last Wednesday from his home in Savannah, Georgia. His mother told the police that she last saw him in his playpen about 6 o'clock in the morning. Dozens of FBI agents and child abduction teams are helping with the search, beginning with the home of Quentin, the one he shares with his mom and a 3-year-old sibling and his grandparents and his mom's boyfriend. Today, for the first time, police publicly acknowledged that Quentin may have been the victim of a crime. And tonight, his own grandparents say that his mother can't be trusted. I want to bring in News Nation senior national correspondent Brian Enten with the latest on a growing investigation. Brian, just after the police chief acknowledged the possibility of foul play, the police and the FBI searched the little boy's home and then began pumping the backyard pool. So that's a big development. Have they found anything?
Yeah, that was an interesting development today, Ashley. They drained the pool. We don't know if they found anything. The police are staying very, very tight-lipped. But something is clearly wrong here. The police today, for the first time, called this a criminal investigation, and it just doesn't make sense. How could this infant just go missing from his playpen? New today, you can hear the sound of a pump coming from the yard where 20-month-old Quentin Simon was last seen near Savannah, Georgia. It appears police are now draining a swimming pool as the search for the missing toddler intensifies.
Now, we are continuing to use every investigative resource available for us to locate little Quentin. We have conducted multiple interviews, executed multiple search warrants, and we've canvassed numerous specific geographic areas.
Police say little Quentin's mother told them she last saw him in his playpen around 6 in the morning Wednesday. The FBI is involved, and authorities have spent the last 5 days extensively searching the area near the family's home.
I need everybody to help, everybody that knows anything, anybody. Brittany needs just a baby.
Quentin's grandparents say the boy's mother's story does not make sense.
She's lied to us so many times, and I don't know. It's just bad to say, but she just likes to lie.
Police have been to the family's house before. According to police reports, family members say Quentin's mom has a history of stealing and using the money to buy drugs. Quentin's babysitter told News Nation station WSAV she heard from Quentin's mom early Wednesday morning when she said she didn't have to watch Quentin that day.
I get a text at 9 o'clock saying, have I seen Quentin? I immediately go to their house. I try to help them look. They didn't want that. My heart is broken. I'm not his mother. I'm not his family, but I love him very much. And I just don't know what could happen. The police did a really good job of looking. And where does a one-year-old go? They've covered a lot of ground.
And today, the police chief, Ashley, said that they have made progress in the investigation, but he would not elaborate. Saying that he did not want to compromise the investigation so far. Ashley?
Okay, but Brian, something you had in your report. The mom says she last saw Quentin in the playpen at 6 a.m. The babysitter says she got the text saying, don't need you today, at 9 a.m. That would be 3 hours later. That's a weird text to get, as opposed to, oh my God, Quentin's missing, come help us.
Yeah, ding, ding, ding. Something is not right here, Ashley. There was actually a text message at 5 in the morning from the mom to the babysitter saying, hey, we don't need your services today. The babysitter said she immediately found it very, very strange because that had never happened before. Even when the mom didn't go to work, they still had the babysitter there to watch that little boy. Wow. The babysitter said she found the text very strange.
So 5 a.m., text goes out, 6 a.m., saying I don't need you to babysit today. 6 a.m., she says I don't see Quentin in his playpen anymore, and babysitter maybe reads the text at 9 a.m. It's all still very, very fishy. Brian Enten, stay on it for us, would you? Would really appreciate it.
You got it, Ashley.
All right, Brian Enten reporting live for us tonight. Quentin was last seen wearing a light blue Sesame Street shirt and black pajama pants, and if you've seen him or have any information on his whereabouts, please call the tip line on your screen. Or just call your local police and ask to help. Coming up, take a look at this fan storming the field at yesterday's Buccaneers-Falcons game in Tampa. Nothing new, right? happens all the time and almost always ends the same way. A fan on his back, the crowd on its feet, cheering on security. Not this time. Why did the fans turn on the guards? The answer's next. Morning only on News Nation. You know, we have all seen it. A fan who presumably paid good money to watch a sporting event from an actual seat storms the field like a moron, goes down hard when security catches them, and usually it's a crowd pleaser. Fans go wild. But tonight, fans are Monday morning quarterbacking the security team at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa. Take a look. He thought he looked a little young, you might be right. His mom says he's just 10 years old. And that's raising all sorts of questions. Did security really have to manhandle a kid? On the other hand, they do have a job to do. Are they supposed to stop and ask people's ages? One thing we might all ask, where were the parents? According to reports, his mother had multiple kids at the game and wasn't aware that it was happening until too late. Been there, sister. Getcha. Totally. Police are also saying the boy is older than 10, but they're not going to say his age because he's still a minor. No charges filed in any case. And on that note, we'll say goodnight. But up next, mega fatigue. Is it a thing as we approach the midterms? Former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci weighs in with Chris on Cuomo, which starts now.